This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's programme...
Reaching an agreement is not equal with us changing our policies towards the region, towards the arrogant systems, and towards our friends and allies in the region.
Iran's deputy foreign minister there on how the nuclear deal won't change his country's attitude to the West. It was only last week that the deal was reached, and it's already disputed what it will mean in the long run. Mary Jajewski and Shashank Joshi will join me on this and the other day's big stories, including Ukrainian and pro-Russian rebels agree to expand a fallback of weapons in eastern Ukraine. In a conflict, though, seemingly free from any central control, will this make any difference? Plus, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev urges Moscow and Europe to rebuild trust. But will he be listened to? And the European Court of Human Rights condemns Italy for failing to provide legal recognition to same-sex couples. That's all ahead on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are Mary Jajewski, who's the chief editorial writer and columnist at The Independent, and also Shashank Joshi, senior research fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start today with a new agreement struck between Ukraine and the pro-Russian rebels. Both sides have now agreed to expand a pullback of weapons in eastern Ukraine. The numbers of tanks and small weapons are to be decreased. But will the conflict, seemingly free from any cohesive central control, actually wind down? And does anyone really have any better ideas of how to bring stability to the region? Mary, let's start with you. You know, it never seems to be quite clear who's talking to who and who's got the backing of who. There is some feeling that, you know, even though Russia is, you know, obviously pulling some of the strings, it's not quite pulling as many as we think. And even for the Ukrainian government in Kiev, there are things happening that they're not quite in charge of. Do we take these discussions as serious, as hopeful?
Well, I take them as slightly hopeful, or at least better than the absence of such moves. Because really what's happened over the last 2-3 months is that the international spotlight has gone off what's been going on in eastern Ukraine. And if anybody was saying anything from outside, it was completely pessimistic. Everybody was saying the Minsk II agreement has no chance of holding. Even if it does, it's entirely in Moscow's advantage and nothing will come of it in the end. Well, these moves can actually be seen as the latest attempt, very tentative, to fulfill another bit of the Minsk II agreement. And we've also seen some of the things that the Kiev government was supposed to deliver going through parliament over the last 2 weeks in the form of constitutional changes to have much more devolution. Now, everybody sort of trashes this and says it doesn't mean anything, it won't actually come to pass, this is going to be a frozen conflict forever. But I think we have seen some movement, and it is possible that things will actually get better rather than worse.
Shashank, is that your feeling too, that there is some hope here that things could settle down?
Well, there's two levels. One of them is the day-to-day violence, and the other one is the big strategic picture of the future of eastern Ukraine. And on the day-to-day picture, I think this is good news. Just to be specific, what they're pulling back on each side is tanks and armored vehicles with weapons of under 100 millimeters. You know, these are fairly sizable pieces of kit that can cause a lot of damage. So I think it's certainly true that in the absence of this agreement and these kind of little understandings, there would be more people getting killed every day. So that's a good thing. On the strategic picture, I think that the really significant phase of this, of Minsk implementation, is going to be towards the end of this year, when you have to look at how much has been done to seal the border off. There's some interesting mixed reports coming in the past few weeks about how, on the one hand, pro-Russian rebels are complaining Moscow isn't giving them the supplies they would like to see and they feel abandoned. On the other hand, there are also indications that there was a story in the New York Times yesterday on how Russia isn't even bothering to conceal some of the military buildup taking place on the border as well. So I will reserve my broader judgment until the end of this year, when we have seen whether that border is really being sealed off in the way that Minsk demands. But I still welcome these kind of pullbacks. I think they have very significant human effects.
Mary, do you think that any of the beneficial changes we are seeing happening are because of the sanctions that are in place against Russia? We've seen today some reporting that, you know, actually the Russians have got very good at kind of dodging them. But they must be a pain at a time when the country's economy isn't doing well. Do you feel that maybe the Russians feel, actually, we will allow some kind of bedding in to take place now? We will draw a line in how far we've gone?
I don't think that the sanctions have really affected Russia that much. There have been these targeted sanctions against individuals. There have been other things which make it very difficult for Russia to raise money on international markets, and that has had a restrictive effect. But the way they've played in Russia has been entirely to Vladimir Putin's advantage, because he can say, look, they're trying to hurt us, and it casts us back on our own resources. And that's actually a good thing for them and in the long term for the Russian economy. So I think there's an element of that. But I also think there's a degree of drawing back on all sides here. And I think it was quite indicative that last week, when we had the anniversary of the Malaysian plane being downed, that actually nobody made an enormous deal of it. It could have been an opportunity for enormous saber rattling on the part of the West. That didn't happen. And I think maybe the word had gone out that things are just moving slightly in a better direction. Don't do anything to damage that.
I think it's very interesting. Mary raises a fascinating point about the efficacy of sanctions. We had this interesting parallel debate about Iran as well, which is Iran also claimed, look, sanctions are helping us. They are helping us with self-sufficiency. We're benefiting. That was true. And they did have some benefits to particular groups within Iran in the same way they've had benefits to particular factions within Russia as well. But regimes under sanctions also always say this, and we sometimes only see the effects over the longer term. And when I've spoken to officials in the US who deal with Russia, particularly in the White House, they emphasize that a great volume of Russian debt is going to come to maturity later this year, later this summer. And that's going to be a really, really painful moment when Russians can't borrow from Western credit markets, and that will be a crunch point where it will really affect the Russians. Whether that's accurate or not, we'll have to see.
Well, you mentioned Iran, and we should look at that Iran deal, because it was only reached a matter of days ago, but already there's some dispute about what it actually means. Just today, the Iranian deputy foreign minister underlined Tehran's message that despite the accord, Iran won't change its anti-Western foreign policy. He also emphasised that Iran has a hard line against nuclear restrictions lasting more than 10 years, and he dismissed the idea that the six world powers might get them extended. And also a few days ago, the US Defence Secretary Ash Carter said that the nuclear deal doesn't prevent the use of military force if needed against Iran. Mary, we're saying this has been a great piece of positive news. It's been a bit of a victory for Obama. We're seeing this against a background of Obama doing lots of really interesting things, like the opening up of relations with another former foe, with Cuba. It doesn't look like the big melting of diplomatic friendship relations with Iran is on the cards at the moment, do you think?
I think that is partly true, but I also think there's a lot of playing to domestic galleries here.
Absolutely.
Both on the part of Iran and on the part of the Americans, because this deal, it's been so long in the making, and it's enormously contested by very strong factions in both countries. So for the time being, I think we should actually let them get on with it, say how dreadful it is, how there are all these sort of get-out clauses, how maybe it won't stick, and maybe we should see that, in fact, as cover for the fact that they need to square domestic constituencies.
Shasha, when it's kind of an extraordinary piece of history when you think, you know, after the revolution, you know, what we thought of Iran, what we thought of Iranians and the mullahs. Oddly, now when we look at Tehran and the people there, they feel oddly like us. When we, in comparison to all the things going on in that neighbourhood, they're concerned about opening shopping malls, and they want to go to the beach and all the things.
Sure.
While there is, again, all this bluster about we won't change, we won't get on. Mm-hmm, actually, behind it, people are watching American films on TV. There's a kind of people are interested in Iran. There's a much more of a kind of a human understanding.
Anyone who's looked at the Middle East knows that the most pro-American population in the region is in Iran. Of course, Ayatollah Khamenei doesn't share that America philia, but it's in the population to a far greater degree than Saudi Arabia or Egypt or Jordan or anywhere like that. I was in Istanbul this morning and yesterday, and I met a lot of Iranians for a conference, and I was asking them about restrictions on information and daily life, and they were saying, as a matter of course, yes, Twitter is banned, but everyone has access to it, just like in China. You know, it's a thing that everyone does, just like they have satellite dishes and other social media. They're completely open to the world in that particular sense. At the same time, I think it's very, very important to remember that when we see these scenes of Foreign Minister Javad Zarif, a very urbane, intelligent man educated in America, laughing and joking with Secretary of State John Kerry, that Zarif is still not the man who pulls the strings in many of the key areas we are interested in. He doesn't pull the strings in Syria, nor in Iraq, nor in Yemen, nor in many other parts of the Gulf. Those are people who are in the murkier shadows of the regime, and they are not the ones celebrating on the front pages of Iranian newspapers this week.
But tell me, Mary, when you look at what's happening, obviously the nuclear deal. Now, beside that, as we were saying, it's interesting what's happening in the region. We're seeing, you know, Iranian troops be advisors, actually, well, across the region. They're helping in Syria, the Assad regime, but they're helping the central government in Iraq. Do you think the Americans hope that there will be more kind of channels of communication with the Iranians? And, you know, while not obviously kind of, you know, uniting on the battlefield, but there will be some kind of way of letting each other know what they're up to?
I think there is some grand calculation in Obama's policy, and that maybe when people look back at his presidency, I mean, he's been enormously criticized for inactivity, for making America look weak, for not doing this, for not doing that, for not waving a big stick, for not being George Bush, a million things. But I think when people look back, they may very well treat him much more kindly as somebody who actually examined and judged the much, much bigger, longer-term picture. And I think maybe reintroducing Iran to the whole geopolitical picture in that enormous area where so much is shifting at the moment, I think that may be seen as a positive part of his legacy.
Shashank, do you think that the problem for Obama is not just what's happening in Israel, is the potential loss of, you know, the sympathy and the reliability of the Saudis as well? So while he kind of gains friends in one quarter, in this kind of topsy turvy world, it feels like you can't keep everybody on board for these, you know, for these talks.
No, but I think Mary was absolutely right to underscore the idea that some of the more extreme verbal pyrotechnics coming out of Tehran and Washington are for domestic consumption. I would suggest that some of the more extreme Saudi posturing is not just for domestic consumption, but to ring the alarm bell, to pull their ally onto side, to say, look, if you don't help us now, you're abandoning us. We need nuclear weapons of our own. We'll destabilize the Middle East ourselves. We will have other allies. We'll turn to maybe the French or maybe the Chinese, the Russians. Take all of that, I would say, with a pinch of salt. The Saudis are deeply concerned, and this will have some long-term effects on that relationship. I think we're going to see the beginning of more activist, assertive Saudi policy, as we've seen in Yemen. But also remember that the Saudis couldn't bomb Yemen without extensive American assistance. They are still yoked in to what remains a very, very US-dominated security architecture for all the Gulf states. So, you know, listen to their protestations with a little bit of skepticism, remembering how much they still rely on Washington for their own defense.
Well, we'll be coming back to this story with a different angle later on in the program. But you're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Mary Jadevsky, and Shashank Joshi. And coming up next, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev urges Moscow and Europe to re-establish trust. But will he be listened to?
The city of Porto is emerging from the shadows, boasting a newfound confidence and an iconic visual identity to match. We meet the city's mayor, who knows a thing or two about winning an urban battle.
I'm like a Swedish grandfather knitting socks, you know, and that's the city I'm trying to build. And maybe there will be a time in the future when we will need heavy infrastructures. But at the moment, that's We are concentrating on the more Schumpeterian approach to the city, on the small is beautiful and the small things we can do.
Porto Revival, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Monocle 24. I'm Midori House, and still with me is Mary Jajewski and Shashank Joshi. In Russia, former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has expressed his concern over the deteriorating relations between the Kremlin and the West. 84-year-old Gorbachev urged Moscow and Berlin to re-establish trust, for example, during an interview for Russian news agency TASS. He emphasized that there is no time to lose, asking for responsibility and wisdom from both governments. Mary, times have changed greatly, and many Russians certainly don't look warmly on Mr. Gorbachev. They feel he was the man that kind of gave away the Soviet Union. Do you think he has any audience back home?
No, but I'm not sure that this was a message that was intended for the Russians. To my mind, this is almost one of the most interesting developments that we've seen all day, because it looks to me as though this was an interview for the Russian, basically, state news agency. They decided, somebody to my mind in the Kremlin, possibly right at the very top, decided that they wanted to send a signal, and they looked around desperately for somebody who would carry conviction, especially in former Western Europe and in Germany, because I think the olive branch is sort of extended to Germany. And the person they came up with, quite correctly, for a Western and a European audience, is Gorbachev. And I think it's in a way the first sign that we've seen. If we go back to the whole sanctions question, the Ukraine question, this is the first sign we've seen, to my mind, that the Kremlin wants an end to this standoff, this East-West standoff, and regards it as dangerous. And I think this reflects a huge change in the Kremlin. And it's basically sending out a signal that they want to be picked up. And so what I'll be doing in the next few days is waiting to see whether maybe there's some sort of reciprocal signal sent from the other side.
I think it's interesting to see the choice of messenger. Gorbachev, of course, much more liked here than he is in Moscow. I think also, unfortunately, his credibility has been tarnished in the last year as well by his posture towards the issue of the annexation of Crimea, his support for many of Putin's activities. I'm not sure he has quite the same moral authority on these matters that he did 18 months ago, and that's rather a shame. But I think that's down to his own choices. I also think that it's interesting to see how Russia played a very significant role over the last 13 years, but also in the last weeks, on the Iran deal. And it's a very important example of tactical, well, more than tactical, but compartmentalized cooperation on a key issue. That said, I would prefer to see concrete signals in behavior rather than signals that I'm afraid I don't think are worth an awful lot through messengers like this. I would wish to see signals in terms of compliance with Minsk, signals in terms of changes in behavior in many of the other aspects we've been concerned about in terms of Russia. But subject to that, yes, reciprocity, I think, is a desirable and sensible thing.
Mary, on a slightly different tangent, it's quite hard, actually, for, you know, the notion of the elder statesman, the person who could kind of rock up in all different sorts of markets and have influence, there's not many of them left, are there? I guess, you know, when you look to the US, like Clinton, some people would value. Kofi Annan's name often gets mentioned in these circumstances. But do you think there are many elder statesmen who, when you're covering foreign affairs, you think, actually, here is one voice that people would listen to?
No, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think that the whole concept of elder statesmen, in a way, it's something that seems rather as though it belongs to the past. And it's very difficult to see, even among today's politicians, who is potentially an elder statesman. You know, maybe Angela Merkel, depends an awful lot on what happens in the next few years. But I think it's interesting that the Russians wheeled out Mikhail Gorbachev, because it does show, in a way, the dearth of anybody else. Mm. And, you know, you said that Gorbachev is 84. He's also in pretty bad health. He's sort of in and out of hospital. He's got a heart complaint. This is not an easy thing for him to be asked to do.
Shashank, Carter, Clinton...
Yeah, it's very interesting. Carter obviously has played that role, but he's also played a very activist, partisan role in that debate, right? He's been extremely pro-Palestinian, and that in some ways has limited his impact in reaching out to all sides in that particular debate. Clinton has done that, but Clinton occupies an interesting place, a little bit like Tony Blair as well, in that they could have been elder statesmen, but their legacies have not being quite as disinterested and apolitical as they might have wished. No one, you know, Tony Blair's role in the Quartet was not viewed as an elder statesman. It was viewed in with comparative scorn, I think. And it's difficult to see from our own policy who are those elder statesmen for us. Is it John Major, perhaps? I mean, he certainly intervened in the European debate. But if we wish to send a message to our adversaries, whether that's Russia or Iran or someone else, who would we send? It's really elder royals. The royal family plays that kind of strange role for us. There's no one else.
I have to pack off the Queen on the quiet. We're going to move on now, because developments in gay rights have made headlines in recent months. In May, Ireland became the first country to legalise same-sex marriage by national referendum. And in June, the US Supreme Court ruled that same-sex marriage was a legal right across the US. In Western Europe, there's still one major country that does not recognise either civil partnerships or gay marriage. And the country is Italy. Now, the European Court has ruled that Italy violates human rights of gay couples by not providing legal recognition. The court ruling puts pressure on Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, who has been a long-time proponent of changing the legislation. Mary, there's a funny thing here. You know, so obviously, Catholic countries, you would imagine, would be caught up in a little bit in being a little bit slower. But actually, Spain was one of the most progressive countries about it. And you also think that is there something here about a lack of modernity? Because again, Spain managed it. Many of these countries did it. There's something about holding on to the past that's still quite deep at the heart of Italy. And you see that in many of the challenges that the country faces. Why do you think that Italy has been so slow? Do you think it's still just, you know, the power of the Vatican?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to come to. I think it's probably more difficult for an Italian government than for almost any other government in Europe to make those sort of reforms that have, as it were, a church, a religious aspect, or are perceived to have a religious aspect to them. Because, of course, civil partnerships do not need to have any sort of relationship with any church. They can be entirely secular. And in a way, that was the huge advantage when they were introduced in Britain first. Civil partnerships the whole thing could be separated from religion. But I suspect that's much more difficult in Italy. Though, I mean, I see that they intend to introduce civil partnerships before the end of the year. But I suspect maybe that public opinion, at least in the north of Italy, is rather ahead of the government here. But in the south of Italy, it may be behind.
Shashank, do you think that this is the kind of call needed to change things in Italy?
I think what's interesting is the tide's been turning for a while. This is the thin end of the spear. Last year was the first time that more people in Italy supported civil partnerships than didn't, so that the tide turned. Berlusconi himself indicated support. And you know, given his control of the media empire in Italy, that has a kind of trickle-down effect. The new Pope himself has taken a softer stance on civil unions in relation to Mary's point about how that is less bound up with religion. Obviously, he's not in favor of gay marriage, but he's softened that position. So the conditions are all set. What I found fascinating were the catalysts and the politics around this, not just the court case, but the fact that you had an Italian politician who was on hunger strike about this issue. I absolutely love that. When in Europe did a politician last go on hunger strike? Not just any politician, a government minister. I absolutely find that fantastic. I like the idea of Michael Gove fasting for several weeks to sort of insist on a change in prisons policy or something.
Especially tough in Italy with all that food as well, right? But finally today, we're going to return to that Iran nuclear deal. It seems that a satirical website has just broken a real news story. A spoof news site, The Onion, released a story headlined U.S. Sues Upset Netanyahu with Shipment of Ballistic Missiles, just 24 hours before it emerged that the U.S. was indeed offering such weaponry to the country. The only difference between The Onion's article and reality was Netanyahu actually rejected the offer. Shashin, what did you make of this? It's a nice piece of second guessing almost what would happen.
The Onion is and always has been genius, and this is not the first time it cuts extremely close to the bone, so much so that it is anticipated a new story. I think it's at some point when you're this close to reality, you're almost forfeiting your status as satire at some point. So I think they have to try harder. They have to make sure they avoid these kinds of stories if they want to keep their status.
Did you admire the skill, Mary, of the Onion's kind of crystal ball gazing?
Well, I mean, in some ways, I wish that I'd thought of that, because in a way it was the completely obvious thing that Obama would offer Israel some sort of sweetener to this deal. And it was striking that Netanyahu actually appeared to be rather taking this more in his stride without a lot of the sort of fireworks that one would have expected, given his really strong opposition to any deal with Iran. So, you know, I think we should all have thought of this before. But the fact that it came out on The Onion and then that was actually corroborated, I mean, who does it devalue and who does it promote? I mean, does it devalue the supposed concession made by the Americans?
Mary, just tell me, you work, obviously, in the world of newspapers, and you're well known in that world. The humour is actually quite valued in newspapers as well, whereas it's the sketch writer or the columnist. When you look through your paper, do you feel that there are you need that sense of actually laughing about these things at times as well?
I think it's become much scarcer in British newspapers. It always used to, 20 years ago, it was a set piece of British newspapers, and indeed of mainstream French newspapers, to have, as it were, a satirical or a humorous column. And that's no longer so. The place has generally been taken by quite a parochial sort of satirical look at sort of Today in Parliament or the political news, the sketch writer. And sketches get written in relation to sort of other things, but mostly domestic. But the set piece satirical column, it doesn't have the same life that it used to.
But I think in place of that, there has flourished a new online sphere of this. And the UK equivalent of The Onion is, of course, The Daily Mash, which has had some similarly fantastic stories. I remember one of them about how Liz Kendall promises at a rally to melt down a statue of the last surviving coal miner and turn it into a giant sculpture of Tony Blair or something. And it, those new online satirical outlets are doing absolutely fantastically well in all these countries, and every national equivalent has replicated The Onion.
And some of the quips that you get just from sort of the public at large that you get on Twitter in immediate response to things are incredibly clever and very, very funny. So maybe they do it better than we do.
And we certainly saw earlier this year, obviously with the Charlie Hebdo story, that it's still a very powerful thing, that world of satire. People find it, whatever the cause is, difficult. And even here at home, Private Eye, I think, kind of managed to kind of upset quite a few people with the things it says. Are you a reader of Private Eye, Mary?
From time to time.
More the street of shame element, is it, about what happens in Fleet Street?
More the front covers.
have you been on a newspaper? I think most people turn to that page, make sure that they haven't been mentioned anywhere during the week. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for joining us on Midori House, Mary Jezeski and Shashank Joshi. Well, that's all we have for on today's show. It was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and also Mariana Zaniga, Paige Reynolds, and also Eugenia Ellenskaya. And our studio manager, well, that was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, actually, Josh Fennett will be keeping you company with Monocle's International Playlist. Don't miss that. Then at 1900 hours, it's The Entrepreneurs, which is brought to you by the one and only Daniel Giacopelli. And at 2200 hours, Well, it's time for the Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. This show is going to be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck, and thank you very much for listening.